Well, he was the only person we had who was a Vietnamese nationalist.
Yes, sir.
And who satisfied American requirements. He spoke English. He wore nice suits.
Mm-hmm.
He was Catholic in a Buddhist country.
That's right.
And so the big thing about him was that he would not accept American troops in Vietnam, except for advisors. He didn't want American troops in Vietnam. And consequently, we didn't send any, and we felt that he was becoming increasingly brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And so did the North Vietnamese. They didn't like him very much.
Right.
And we ought to get rid of him. He put his brother in a high position, next to, second only to him, in charge of the strategic hamlets, and they weren't very well done. And Buddhists more or less had a little revolt in Hue, and his brother took army troops to put down the so-called revolution. It wasn't a revolution. It was a protest by the Buddhists. And the Buddhists didn't like him very much either because he was Catholic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we thought that we had to get rid of him in order to get American troops over there to do something. Now, the North Vietnamese, they thought he was pretty bad, too. And they wanted to defeat him. They liked him because he was a nationalist. He wouldn't accept American troops. And they thought they could defeat him before any American troops arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we wouldn't have a war.
And they wouldn't have to face American forces.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans were feeling just the opposite. They had to get rid of him and get in there.
Now, let me just stop you just for a second and ask,
sure.
Colonel, what do you think about the controversy now embedded in the historical literature,
mm-hmm.
about whether President Kennedy during the summer and late fall of 1963 was thinking about decreasing the U.S. Advisory commitment?
Well, I think he was.
You do?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that he would have sent troops in order. He approved of a coup against them. It was a great surprise to him when they were killed. He didn't want them to be killed. They were offered a safe passage by Ambassador Lodge, but they wouldn't take it. And so the generals killed them. And from that time on, in my opinion, there was what little legitimacy there was to the South Vietnamese government disappeared. There was no legitimacy there. Siem was the one. And other than Siem, there were just a bunch of generals.
Now, at that point, of course, just a couple of weeks later, President Kennedy himself was killed.
Yeah, a couple of months later.
And do you see that as a crucial turning point then?
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the Vietnamese saw it as a crucial turning point because that allowed American troops to come in. And Kennedy and Diem didn't want American troops to come in, and the North Vietnamese didn't want them either because they thought they could defeat Diem.
Mm-hmm.
And killing Diem upset all their plans.
So actually both sides of the equation then changed.
Both sides changed, yeah.
Such that American...
Americans were eager to get in. The American command, it seemed, were eager to get American troops in to protect our airfields, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Vietnamese were anxious to defeat Diem to keep American troops out.
Do you can you evaluate incoming President Johnson's agenda for Vietnam, if he had one when he first took office?
Well, he probably didn't. But he had the Great Society.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He was going to implement the Great Society and get rid of poverty in the United States. And he told the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, take care of that little pissy-ant country over there. There's nothing going on, and we can beat them, and you take care of that, and I'll get on with the Great Society. Well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't know how to do that. How do you not lose the war?
Yeah.
Also, President Johnson, perhaps not at this time, but later on, felt that he was not going to be the Democratic president who lost another country to communism. Truman had lost, he had lost it. Truman was in power when the Chinese communists came in, and he took hell from the Republicans for losing communist China to the communists. And so Lyndon Johnson was not going to be the president who lost another, the Democratic president who lost another country to communism.
And, Colonel, do you think that that specter of being tagged with being, you know, the next Democrat who handed over an Asian country to communists, did that had a lot to do with how he reacted when the Gulf of Tonkin incidents took place in August 1964?
Absolutely.
Okay. That he was thinking, I have to respond?
Respond, yes, okay. Exactly.
How much credence do you give to the standard conventional interpretation of what happened out there in the Gulf of Tonkin?
Well, what the North Vietnamese told us was it was the local commander's prerogative to defend himself. The Politburo in Hanoi had nothing to do with it. And were quite surprised when they were bombed because of that. It was the local commander who was defending himself.
Now, when did you find that out, sir?
Well, when I was over there in 98.
Okay, with Secretary?
Yeah, well, McNamara didn't go.
Oh, okay, this was your other trip.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. Do you believe that?
Probably, yeah.
Sounds right?
Yeah, sounds right to me.
Mm-hmm.
They were just defending themselves.
Wow. And so
they said because of the bombing, mm-hmm. they figured that more bombing would follow, and so they evacuated Hanoi at that time. Sent all their women and children out to the countryside.
Of course, because they didn't know how broadly the U.S. would respond.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. But in fact, the reprisal airstrikes by the United States were primarily along the coast. Is that
that's
correct?
That's right. Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay. And I suppose just what were understood to be the launch points for those patrol craft.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. Was it important in your thinking as a strategist, now thinking back on that time, was it important that the U.S. established a precedent of being willing to use aerial power against
them? No, it wasn't, because it didn't do any good at all. You see, the North Vietnamese saw the first war as the special war, where U.S. advisors were trying to get the Vietnamese to fight each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw the bombing as a admission that that war had failed.
Really?
That we had to try something else. Mm-hmm. And so we tried bombing. Mm-hmm. And the bombing didn't hurt them very much. And then we sent troops in after Jim died, and that was the end of the bombing. The bombing had failed. They never felt that they were on the verge of losing. They were always... ahead, every change we made in our strategy was an admission of the failure of the previous strategy.
Interesting. Is this something that you sort of appreciated at the time or in your own study, or is this more based on your visits in 1998?
Yeah, my visits in 1998.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Who did you speak to in 1998? Do you remember?
I got it written down here. Let me...
Okay, good.
We spoke to a lot of people.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. I spoke to one in particular.
Who organized that trip, by the way?
Oh, the Brown University.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the Rockefeller Foundation. They had taken a similar trips to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
To talk about the Russian and Cuban missile crisis. And they thought this would be a good idea to do the same thing about Vietnam.
How did they come to select you, sir? I mean, obviously your preeminence in the field, but do you know how
sure.
your name surfaced?
I volunteered. The first visit with McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
They took two generals, Phil Smith, general in the Air Force, and Dale Vesser, lieutenant general in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next time, they planned a follow-up trip, and the Vietnamese told them, don't bring McNamara and all those generals and historians.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, why? And they said, because we want to talk, and if you bring McNamara our side, we'll appoint someone of equal stature whose job will be to keep us from talking.
Right, that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
And so I knew those two generals, and I wrote to them and said, hey, if you're going back, I know something about this. And so then they recommended me to McNamara and interview with him, and he agreed that I should replace the two generals.
So you had a meeting with McNamara?
McNamara, oh, yeah, sure.
Where did that take place? Was that in Washington? Or?
Well, he has an office in Washington, and
mm-hmm.
We met there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also met at the Cosmos Club in Washington before we left.
That must have been an interesting couple of meetings.
Oh, yeah.
What did you and the former secretary talk about?
Well, we talked about the unlikelihood of military victory.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to call his book initially Missed Opportunities. And I thought that was a good title, but then they changed it to Press Changed It to Argument Without End.
So that was actually a publicity people's decision?
I guess so. They did
uh-huh.
that.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote a chapter there called Illusion, an Illusion of Military Victory. I'm writing another book now called The War That Couldn't Be Won, because I don't think it ever could.
Interesting. Well, when are we going to get to see that?
Well, I don't know. I'm still talking to the Rutgers University Press.
Oh, okay. Good.
And it'll probably be in the winter sometime.
Is the manuscript complete?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
I still have another chapter or something.
Well, I will look forward to that.
Okay, well, I'll call you and tell you when.
Okay, good. I hope you will.
Yeah.
I hope you will. Well, let me, did you find the name of the fellow that you primarily exchanged views with?
Let me see.
If not, we can come back to that, of course.
Oh, Colonel Quach, Quachhai.
Mm-hmm.
His second name, Quach Hai Lung, Luong.
Quach Hai Lung.
Yeah, he was a air defense commander, and then he is now a historian, a strategist at the Institute of International Relations in Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
That's like our Foreign Service Institute. They take their old retired diplomats and put them there to teach.
And he was an air defense commander during...
Right, during the war.
American period of the war.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And now he's my old buddy.
And how old is he? You have any idea?
No idea.
Do you continue to sort of exchange letters or emails?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. There was another one, Quach Hai Lung, that's a different guy. No, I'll have to look at him, who I exchanged letters with. There's a funny little guy, I'll have to look up his name,
mm-hmm.
who... was in India at the time, who has been a revolutionary since he's 14.
Wow.
And he wanted to know about what was good to consider some literature about a draftee army versus a volunteer army, and I sent that to him.
Mm-hmm.
And what else did he want to know? He wanted to know a couple of things, but he's looking to the future.
Interesting that they're considering those issues.
Yeah.
At the same time the United States is as well.
Well, it is because they have so many people in the Army.
Oh,
and, yeah.
And the cost is
the cost
huge.
Is bad, but the cost of letting them go into a poverty-stricken country
mm-hmm.
with no jobs is even worse, probably.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
The dislocation from demobilization is always difficult.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, going back to the 1964, then 1965 period,
yeah.
When President Johnson ran for re-election,
oh yeah,
what impact do you think that had on thinking or planning for perhaps gradually escalating U.S. commitments in South Vietnam?
Well, I think people thought that Johnson was a better choice than Goldwater. The Goldwater said we should. we should even nuke them. And,
and
Johnson said, no, no, let's be reasonable. We can talk to him about it. I have big plans for the United States. So he downgraded it, even though during the campaign there were a couple of attacks on Americans in Benoit Air Base and at the, Brinks Hotel.
Down in Saigon?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Johnson, even before the election, set up a study group to study what we should do about Vietnam. And this was kind of a disaster because a lot of the options weren't given to him. I remember the CIA sent in a document that said that the insurgency in South Vietnam was largely indigenous, and that bombing the North would probably have no effect. And a Navy admiral, whose name I won't tell you, in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, "We can't tell the president that. It's too negative."
So,
and he was too negative. It was absolutely correct.
Right.
But
and
Johnson never heard that.
Yeah, I think that this is one of the marked features of one of your papers that I have in my hand that you wrote while you were at the Congressional Research Service. Certainly based on your dissertation research, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The president didn't get a whole lot of alternative proposals as to how to move forward.
No, the only thing they told him was bomb now and bomb later. So they started bombing.
Do you think that Johnson was one who would have worked well with a series of competing alternatives in front of him? Like, for example, apparently President Kennedy could evaluate different competing proposals, or was Johnson more like a President Nixon who wanted, you know, things to come to him kind of already set, and then he would bounce his own ideas off of it.
Johnson had his Tuesday afternoon luncheons with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he liked things to come to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't always accept them when they came to him. He'd say, think of something else. And I told McNamara one time, well, you know, when he went to visit Westmoreland before U.S. troops came to Vietnam.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Westmoreland said there's only one option available to us, send in more troops. And I told him whenever he heard that, he should tell the commander, go back and give me three more options.
Well, let me just clarify, you having mentioned that, Colonel, when did you first have a chance to talk to Secretary McNamara? When was the first time you met him?
Oh, probably in his office when he was deciding whether I should replace these two generals.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that discussion that you were having was in probably 1998.
Yeah, that's interesting. It was 1997 because I went over there in January of 98.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks. Yeah. That's 1997. In February 65, I think you were probably still at, you were probably in Massachusetts at that point, Fort Devens. Does that sound right?
February 60.
Or General Staff College. I can't remember which.
No, it was probably Leavenworth.
Oh, okay.
And then I went to Massachusetts after Leavenworth in August of 65,
right.
And then I went overseas in about October 65.
Now, certainly during that time period, early 65, the first couple, 3 months, when the large Viet Cong attack at Ple Khu took place, and then the reply with flaming dart runs against North Vietnam. You were no doubt watching those events closely. What did you make of it? Did you think you were probably on your way to Vietnam?
We probably were. Yeah,
okay.
We were again filling up. We were transferred to the 1st Division.
Yes.
And the Army Times had a big headline. Have you been ordered to dye your underwear green? That means you're going to Vietnam. We had green underwear hanging out every window.
And was that at Fort Devens?
Yeah.
We had green underwear everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
We dyed. Every man had to come in and make out a will and all that sort of stuff. And we were filling with people. We get a call from Fort Hood from sergeants who were coming to us saying, should they bring their families? And we'd say, well, no, you better leave them there for a while.
And you also mentioned, I think, in our earlier session about that you were actually given 1 to 50,000 TAC maps.
Maps, yeah,
mm-hmm,
sure.
Yeah.
So our battalion got the whole battalion in the auditorium, and he said, I can't tell you where we're going. That's classified. But I'll tell you what we do when we get there. We're going to kill Viet Cong.
And did everybody pretty much go nuts? Was that inspiring? Was that inspiring?
Oh, yeah, everybody cheered. Hooray. That's what we want to do.
Now, Herb, let me ask you about the command structure. When you when the battalion was shifted into and made part of the 1st Division,
yeah.
What was your rank, first of all, and who were you reporting to?
Well, I was a major executive officer, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Infantry, and I reported to the battalion commander. Now, there was the brigade commander that the battalion commander reported to, but he didn't go with us, I think. There were two battalions in a brigade, and so it just disbanded the brigade, and we weren't really reporting to anybody. It got to be a problem later on because the commander of the 1st Division was also the commander of Fort Riley, and he said, oh, yes, let's take those mess hall tables with us. Well, that didn't apply to Fort Devens.
Okay.
And so when we wound up with the division in Vietnam, we were lacking a lot of things that they had just taken with them because the commanding general had said so.
So you were under-equipped when you first got there, would you say?
Well, yeah, I think everybody was. They sent everybody over, and we were told to take 6 months' worth of equipment with us because they weren't going to get anything until they built up an infrastructure.
Now, you told us last time about your trip over on by ship.
Yeah.
And that you landed at Vung Tau.
Yeah.
Then you'd gone to Bien Hoa.
We went to Bien Hoa to pick up our equipment, right.
Right, and then up to Lai K. And that's sort of where we left it. Can you describe, you told me that you had lived for the next 7 months from September 1965. You guys were living in tents.
Yeah.
Can you describe the terrain? Where were you? How close to, for example, the big plantations up there?
Well, we were right in the middle of the big plantation.
Right in the middle?
Oh, yeah. There were rubber trees all around.
Mm-hmm. Now, why was that position chosen?
I have no idea.
Was it not a good decision?
Well, it was a little city. It was the Rubber Research Institute of Life up in France, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we had electric lights and everything there. Had water, so I guess that's why it was chosen.
Oh, okay, for the water and...
And the lights.
Okay.
And the roadway in the area was very big. The road went right past my tent, which was back in the rubber trees. So it was a pretty well-set up camp.
And how many men were up there when you first arrived, when you first got there? Were you among the first people there?
Yeah, sure. There were two battalions, the 1st Battalion and the 2nd Battalion. And we set a perimeter, the 28th, 2nd, the 28th. There were three or four. The whole 1st Brigade at the 1st Infantry Division was there.
Okay.
And that's where we met our 1st Brigade Commander, because the Brigade Commander didn't come over. The Brigade Commander Fort Devens did not come over on the ship, but the brigade commander from the 1st Division was there. We were attached to him in the 1st Division.
Okay. And did that arrangement stick?
Yeah.
Through
the
time you were there? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And who was that commander?
Broadbeck. Colonel Broadbeck was the brigade commander at Lai K.
And did you have much interaction with him?
I didn't personally until later, but some people did, yeah.
Okay.
Battalion commander did, I'm sure.
Okay. And who were you reporting to?
Battalion commander.
Who was?
George M. Shepherd, Jr., Lieutenant Colonel.
Oh, yeah. I think you mentioned him before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that you did.
He was very good.
Yeah, he was a good guy, yeah.
Fantastic leader.
And what did you learn from him?
Well, I learned a lot about how to run a battalion.
Like what kinds of things for somebody who doesn't have a clue what that job would be? What kinds of things could you learn?
Well, he had a meeting every week with all the staff officers of the battalion. We learned about how to command the battalion, about radio discipline. Didn't use that very much. We didn't use radios very much. I learned about, in a helicopter, what kind of communications you have, how to use the communications.
Would he operate a command post from a helicopter?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sort of leads in. Well, let me ask you first of all. You mentioned radio discipline and that you guys did not use radio communications very heavily. It's probably clear why not, but could you explain why not?
Well, because the South Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, were very good in picking up our signals.
Okay. So they had a signals intelligence operation?
Yes, I think they had a good one. I don't know if they spoke English or not, but sure. Outside of Lycae, one time we found the Viet Cong camp with a little radio, and they had the Stars and Stripes and the American scheduled broadcast.
Really?
Yeah.
That must have been a little worrying.
So, yeah, somebody from Lycae was bringing it out to them.
Wow. Well, when you arrived up there September how quickly did you come into contact with the enemy? I know you guys were involved in a couple of big...
Well, there was a little village out front. We had some fire incidents. I don't think it was anything. And we went out, and on the 3rd of November, we were attacked by the VC regiment.
Now, this is a really important engagement.
Yeah.
It emerges all over the place in the secondary literature, as you know.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what you remember and just take us through what happened?
Well, they were up there, and they got into a knife position, which we call a locker, where they put a knife position.
Mm-hmm.
And we threw things into them at night that they couldn't carry with them, like... 4.2-inch mortars and a lot of picks and shovels and some barbed wire. So they all dug holes and they had barbed wire around them. And early in the morning, they got attacked by the 242 regiment.
The 242 VC regiment.
VC regiment,
yeah.
Right.
About in what strength? Did you have any idea at the time?
Oh, no idea. No. But pretty good strength. We had a... battalion of armored personnel carriers from the cavalry were up there with us.
From the 1st Cav?
Wasn't the 1st Cavalry Division. It was 1st, I don't know, it wasn't the 1st. It was the Cavalry Battalion in the 1st Division.
From the first Infantry Division, the cavalry element.
That's right.
Okay.
And I was back in the base camp, you know, commanding it. And I've moved forward with the reinforcing company. And by that time, the battle was over. Anyhow, we had fantastic air support.
I want to ask you about that.
Airplanes coming from all over. We had, within the battalion, they changed it later on, but within the battalion we had a Air Force officer and an enlisted man in a radio jeep. So they called people in right to us.
And were they calling in Air Force, or were they calling in guys from the carriers?
No, Air Force, Navy, everything.
They
were getting them all. We had so many. And then we had artillery from Lycae. So we had to draw a line and say, okay, artillery south of the line, air strikes north of the line, because we couldn't have them both together.
And were you...
I was back in the back listening to all this.
And what role did you play? I'm sure that you must have done some talking.
Well, I led the counterattack from Lycae to rescue them. By the time we got there, it was all over anyhow.
How long did it take to get the reinforcement element together and moving forward?
Oh, about 15, 20 minutes.
Really? So how long did the actual battle
last?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let's see. The morning, they started at dawn, and then... It lasted till about 10 or 11 o'clock.
And somewhere in there, a decision was made to bring up some reinforcements.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you were kind of put in charge of getting them up there?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
They were from another battalion, but I just got up there.
You moved them
forward.
Now, how did you actually advance? Were you in an armored personnel carrier?
No. We advanced on foot. We went right in, but it was over by that time. We just helped.
You guys probably didn't really know that.
No,
right?
We didn't know it.
So that must have been, nerve-wracking. Can you tell me what, if you remember, Herb, what were you thinking as you were moving forward? You know you're going forward.
It was nerve-wracking. No,
you were ready?
We were ready to go. Yeah.
Were you disappointed then when?
Oh, sure.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Now.
That's what the battalion commander told me one time. He said, well, he had 9 kids. He said, I got 9 kids. Maybe he had 11. He had 11 kids.
Uh-huh.
And he says, you remind me of them. You want to go out to North K waving your pistol and win the Medal of Honor? And I said, yes, sir.
Well, that wasn't the day for that, apparently.
That's right. No.
Tell me about the casualties on both sides, if you remember.
Well, we got about 24 killed,
mm-hmm.
and about 80 wounded. And there must have been hundreds of the others. We didn't get him in the back of the woods mm-hmm. where the airstrikes were going on.
Right.
We must have killed about 400 or so.
So that's
what we reported was about 400 or
okay.
so.
Okay. And that, of course, would have been an estimate.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Was there any policy about going and trying to count?
Oh, no. We had a policy. The next day we went out there and dug a big ditch and dumped the ones we could find in it so it wouldn't smell so bad.
Mm-hmm. And who would get that kind of duty?
No, our men, the ones that killed them.
Okay. Yeah. And how did the guys carry that out? Were they kind of,
Well, it was really just the bulldozer that did
Really?
A bunch of bulldozers. I guess we had an engineer company up there.
And
they dug the hole
and just
pushed everybody in.
Just scooted them in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it's really funny. When I was in Hanoi, I went to the Army Museum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Army Museum had a big picture. Well, the first building they had there was the war against the French.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a fighter plane, the wreckage of a fighter plane in the middle. And then you go in the next building, and it's the war against the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went in there, they had a big picture of American soldiers walking past a bunch of dead bodies on the side. And they say Americans walked past their dead at Balfang November 3rd, 1965. And I told the little girl guy, I said, that captain is wrong. That's my battalion, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Infantry. And those aren't dead Americans. Those are dead Vietnamese they are walking by. That was our first battle and our first victory. And she said, well, you seem to be awful proud of it. And I said, yeah, we killed a lot of people that day. And I don't think they changed the caption any.
That's a strange mistake for them to make, isn't it?
No, it was propaganda. They weren't going
to acknowledge
who
had been killed.
Yeah.
Now, when you say that was the first battle and the first victory,
yeah.
Are you talking about, can you say why you say that?
Well, for us it was.
For the United States.
For the second battalion, second infantry.
Right. And you guys went on to another battle.
Months later.
Yeah. Was this about the 5th of December? Does that sound right?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
5th of December.
Mm-hmm.
3rd of November and the 5th of December.
Now, what happened on that occasion?
Well, on that occasion, a South Vietnamese regiment at Dao Tieng had been attacked and defeated by a Viet Cong regiment who then disappeared. So we were flown into Dao Tieng, which is a big Michelin rubber plantation,
mm-hmm.
and we started ripping to the woods south, and we came upon the base camp of the 242 regiment.
So it was the same regiment as...
Yeah, mm-hmm. and we attacked them.
And
we beat a lot of them. We had 42 killed, and it was out of artillery range from both Feng Tao, both Lai Ke and Dao Qing.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, we called in airstrikes, and airstrikes did a lot. We found a whole bunch of rice that they had stockpiled there. It's very hard to destroy rice.
Right.
We threw some of it in the river. We tried to burn some of it. And that was... that ended up at night. And we got the dead out the next day. We got the wounded out that night.
Now, how... You said you were flown in. Did you come in on helicopters?
Yeah, oh, sure.
Okay. So how important at this point was the air mobile concept for the 1st Division broadly or for the...
Well, the 1st Division wasn't so much.
Mm-hmm.
We had 24 helicopters.
Okay.
Which we could request when we needed them, and we can get the battalion in there.
Uh-huh.
We would fly things in at night, like I said, which were too heavy to carry, including food and... barbed wire and 4.2 inch mortars. We fly them out the next day so they could continue on with their movement.
I see. And your guys came in on those helicopters. And how close were you to what emerged as the base camp when you landed?
We didn't know, but we were about 3 or 4 miles, I guess.
Okay. And can you describe the camp? Did you actually walk around it once you had secured the area? Did you actually?
Well, I didn't because I was busy getting the dead out that day.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I stayed down at the helicopter landing site, which was about 400 or 500 yards from the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And all the dead were brought down there, and I was calling in helicopters and evacuating the dead. The night before, I was evacuating the wounded and sending some food up to them.
So you were kind of is it fair to say, a key person in in managing the sort of, as it were, the aftermath of the battle?
Oh, yeah. I was battalion executive officer. That's what I did.
Right.
Putting for medals for those guys and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So was there a lot of paperwork involved?
Oh, yeah. At that time in Vietnam, the Army was still in a peacetime mode. It changed later on to every... citation had to be done in 5 copies with witness statements and so on. Later on, it didn't get to be so complicated.
But at that point, were you actually taking witness statements?
Oh, yeah. I told everybody to write down, not at that point, but later when we got back, to write down what they had seen and who they wanted to set up and what the witness statements would be, and then I'd decide what kind of medal they'd get and turn it in.
That sounds like a lot of a busy work after
it
the
was, yeah.
after the
after
engagement.
After the battle, yeah.
So that engagement, how long would you say that there was actually firing by U.S. troops?
Oh, they were about 4 hours there.
And
they stayed out that night, and then the next day that night we all went back to Lai Ke. I remember that night because I was bringing up the rear with my Jeep.
Yeah.
So we went back to Lai Ke that day.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next day, we came back to bury the dead, the Vietnamese dead.
And again with the bulldozer type approach?
Yeah, same thing.
Mm-hmm. After those two battles, how did you assess the VC? You're seeing, you know, large unit Viet Cong. How were you assessing them as an enemy at that point?
Well, at that point, it was very well done. They were all well organized. They all had little bags of rice and little bags of Nung Mam, which is the sauce they put on it. They were all they were good fighters. They came right up to the wire before we killed them. They had good mortars. Honest, they were very good.
What?
But they had no air power or no artillery. So,
were they using, what kind of tactics were they using? You said they were coming up on the wire. Were they just essentially throwing themselves?
Yeah,
onto
they just
the wire?
Potentially came up and attacked. You know.
Is it fair to say they were using? I mean, I don't,
human way of tactics.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
That's
but
right,
is that really what they were doing?
Sure, that's all they had.
Gosh. And
I remember talking to a Vietnamese in Lae that day. He went in Ba Bang that day. The battle was in Ba Bang. He wanted to know if I could eat the cow that was killed, the bullock, and I told him, yeah. And he said, it's very dangerous for Americans to come out here. And I said, not anymore. Those are dead Vietnamese, not dead Americans.
Did you feel that the 2-2 had basically cleared this area of V.C.?
No.
It wasn't that simple.
No, we went back to the IK, and every once in a while we'd look at a helicopter would fly over, and we'd see all the trucks and buses stopped, and the D.C. were up there, collecting taxes, I guess. That's when I wanted to go out and get them. We wouldn't.
And tell me a little bit about that. How frustrating was that for you guys?
Well, it's very frustrating for me because I could see them out there, and I wanted to go stop. We had a village, Ba Bang, to the north of us, and a village to the east of us, whom I don't even know the name, but we never went in those villages. Whatever was going on out there, we didn't know that was Indian country, you know.
And where did those orders that you guys could not pursue the enemy you could see, where you could not go into these villages?
I don't think we had any orders. We just weren't ordered to do it. Now, the Ben Cat was south of us, and that's where the Vietnamese province administration was, and our district administration was.
Yes.
And so that was our town. But the two others outlying, I don't know.
Did you ever make it up to An Lac?
No.
Or how far?
No. The division headquarters moved to An Lac, but I never got there.
Oh, okay. So you then... Is it fair to say that you then just, you remained in Lae Cay?
For seven months, yeah.
And were you building up the base during this period?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
They were putting artillery in, they were building up roads and so on. I stayed there 7 months and I got a new battalion commander.
Who was that?
His name was, I don't really remember.
Okay.
And I served for about a month under him. And then I decided to get out of there because he was learning all the lessons we had learned. He was losing people doing it. And the worst thing you could say to him was, this is the way we used to do it.
That would set him off?
Yeah. He wanted to do it his way.
Mm-hmm.
And he got people killed doing it his way and learning the things we'd already learned.
Was he just not taking advice?
Well, yeah, he was learning himself. He was a lieutenant colonel. He was going to do it his own way.
So somebody like you didn't really...
I didn't like it very much.
Mm-hmm. And how did you arrange to get out of Lae Cay then?
Well, I went down to division headquarters, and they said, well, gee, if you come down here, one of us has to go out there. So they weren't too pleased about that.
Uh-huh.
And so I went down to Saigon, and... I had a friend who was working for AID, and he got me into Saigon, into J-33, the Revolutionary Development Division, which he thought I should be in. So I got transferred to Saigon.
Now, that was in July 1966?
Yes.
Okay. Before I ask you more questions about that, Herb, let me ask you about the broader picture that I know you've spent a lot of time looking at.
Yeah.
And particularly the development of the strategy of attrition. What can you tell me about how that sort of came into being as the Army's strategy in Vietnam?
Well, I think it came out of Westmoreland's mind that we could beat them, and we were beating them. You know, we lost 23 killed, and we killed 400 or 500 of them. And so I think Westmoreland thought that we could attrit them.
And that we could just bleed them, and eventually they would collapse eventually?
That's right.
That was such a different strategy from what the Army had pursued and practiced in the two previous major wars, World War II and Korea.
Well, what the Joint Chiefs of Staff were always advocating to the president is that we go in forcefully. We have a forceful bombing campaign. We have a forceful entry in the land war in the South. But the problem was, first of all, the president didn't want to bomb Haiphong, Hanoi, because the Russians and the Chinese had ships and had embassies there.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to bomb close to the border with China because they were shipping stuff in that way, but they were still Chinese and Russians. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff never agreed with that. Also, in the South, we had to build up gradually because there was no facilities there. Even Westmoreland said gradually, we got to build up gradually. But they wanted a big campaign, and we'd get in there and fight. The war was fought in the South.
Yes, sir.
And unfortunately, North Vietnamese had sanctuaries they could go to, and the president was not going to have the war spread to Laos or Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
We bombed in Cambodia on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but didn't send any troops in until Nixon's time. And the president wanted a small, a limited war using limited resources in a limited area. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff never agreed with that.
Mm-hmm.
So Westmoreland adopted an attrition strategy which would never work under the president's limitations.
And so he continued to come back with more requests.
More requests, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
It always got to be the same. Westmoreland wants this many men. Well, that's a lot of men. How many can we give him without calling up the reserves? Well, we can give him this many. Okay, well, have him request that many. Wait, correct. Requested 25,000. 25,000 is approved. I've given the field commander everything he ever asked for.
Wow. Well, let me ask about this, the distinction that you're drawing between the president and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You know, of course, Herb, that, again, embedded in the secondary literature and in a lot of Vietnam veterans' minds is the idea that LBJ handcuffed the military by putting these political restrictions on.
It was a political war.
And what do you mean?
The use of the military was for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we teach our people at the Industrial College and the War College is that the military is an instrument of policy. There must be some objective that the military is being used for.
And that's a politically determined objective.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the way it was.
Now,
that's the way the military refused to accept.
Among the Air Force veterans that I've talked to particularly, there's a feeling of resentment that they weren't allowed to go to Hanoi until later. They weren't allowed to bomb up near the Chinese border, and that, you know, they were really handcuffed in North Vietnam, whereas the Marines and Army land forces in South Vietnam got to go out and basically kick butt. Does that distinction sound right to you?
No.
That there were more political controls on the air war than there were?
Political controls on the air war, there certainly were.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the political controls, they didn't do any good.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do any good. So more air power always meant more prisoners for the United States. And it didn't do any good. They expected it. Our Vietnamese friend, Air Defense Commander, said the typical picture at the time was a factory worker or a farmer in the field with a gun slung over his shoulder.
Right.
And every time the bombers would come over, they would all go out and they'd shoot up in the air. And they figured if they put a billion bullets up there, that one or two of them might hit an airplane. And they were right.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do anything.
But that's not a very efficient way to defend a country against.
The Think Pack After Action Report for 1966 said, maybe it was 67, I forget.
Mm-hmm.
It said we had so many missions, we had so many bombs dropped, He said, we destroyed so many roads, we destroyed so many boxcars, we destroyed so many trucks. And he said, with a prodigious effort, at the end of 1967, the Vietnamese transportation system was slightly improved over where it was at the beginning. Well, I mean, how can a stupid man say a thing like that?
It's a little
and if we wanted to improve the North Vietnamese transportation system, we could have done it a lot more efficiently some other way.
It's a little counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, did you feel, as a major, that there were political controls on what you in the 1st Division were doing as well?
No, because every time we went out, we met a battalion of Viet Cong, and we had a big fight.
And certainly the two instances that you've recounted for us, those certainly were considered victories, were they not?
Oh, yeah. We killed a lot of them.
Let me ask, what impact or what did you know about the battles that were taking place in the Yadrong Valley at the same time, a little earlier, in fact, than your...
We didn't know anything about it.
You had no idea?
No.
Latterly, as a scholar now, thinking about those encounters, were those battles essentially the same as what you were fighting in Three Corps?
No, no. In Three Corps, we were fighting Viet Cong.
Not NVA, sure.
Not NVA, and the NVA say that their first action was in the Yadrong Valley with regular Vietnamese forces, North Vietnamese forces.
But tactically, these were both big unit actions.
Yeah. Well, they had more publicity than we did because they had more newsmen with them.
That's true. I actually looked. I could only find one New York Times article about the fight in November 65 that you were involved in.
Yeah.
Charles Moore was the reporter. I don't know if you ever saw him.
Oh, M-O-H-R.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw him. Yeah, I met him one time.
Did you?
Yeah. Beverly Watson was up there. She was a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor.
So you had a female reporter up there.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Beverly Depp, she was called, D-E-P-P-E.
Why'd they call her that?
That was her name.
Oh, that was her name?
Yeah, Beverly Depp or Deep or something like that.
Oh, okay. And how did you meet her as well?
Oh, sure.
What was your impression of her?
Well,
was she a tough cookie? Or?
Yeah, she was very nice, but she was a tough cookie. Okay. But everybody was looking for an ambush. You see, they come in, I remember our second battle. Newspaper reporter was there the second day, and he said, was this an ambush? And I said, no, it wasn't an ambush. It was a meeting engagement. We found their base camp, and we destroyed it. So he wrote up as an ambush. You know, everybody was looking for an ambush.
It was interesting. The article I saw by Charles Moore used exactly that language. He used the word ambush, and then he said that someone in the American command told him it was actually an advance toward contact.
Yeah,
so. Does that sound like something you would have said?
I might have said. I told him it was a meeting engagement. We were advancing to sign them, and we found them, and we killed them.
I think that might have been you who was the source there.
Might have been.
But were you already a little bit suspicious about the press and how they were going to present things?
Oh, yeah.
Where did that just kind of come with the territory, or was there something
specific?
I think
so. They kept asking about ambushes. Wow. They weren't trying to find out what happened. They had their own answers.
Did that apply to everybody, or were there any exceptions as you went through?
No, that, most of them.
Really?
I remember Dan Rather was there and helped us take some of the bodies out of the jungle that day, but I don't guess he wrote up anything about it.
Now, this was one of those two battles, November or December?
That was December, yeah.
No kidding. Was he filming? Did he have a crew with him? Or?
Apparently he did. There was a German crew there. I remember them very well because they said, okay, they're ready to go back now. And I was there evacuating the dead. And I said, well, the last helicopter's left for the night. And they were panicked.
I'll believe that. What happened to them?
I got them back.
I
was just kidding.
You sort of took pity on them and let them know that there was another helicopter.
Yeah.
What about Dan Rather? You know, he's...
I didn't spend any time with him.
But did you know that he was a network news guy?
No. at that time, they had a picture of him in their advertisements over here. It wasn't until I got back over here
mm-hmm.
and I saw that picture of him carrying bodies out of the jungle. You know, there are four guys' body bag.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And he was on the right-hand side.
Then you realized, oh, he's a star.
Yeah, he's a big timer.
but at the time, he was just another guy out there.
Yeah, out in the way, having me get our bodies out.
Interesting. Well, during that spring of 1966, when you were up at Lykke and the buildup was going on, can you tell me what your additional duties as the executive officer consisted of?
Well, basically awards and decorations.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do that. I was just trying to think what else I did during that time.
Was that something that was important to you personally, or was it just a duty? I'm just trying to get at how you would go about that.
It was probably a duty, but it was important to me personally because I told the guys just write up what they'd seen. You know, one guy wrote a thing, said he was sitting in his foxhole and he got wounded and he fought until he died. I remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Have a sense of sadness or pride or
some
of all of that?
To give them something, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When you managed to arrange your transfer out of Lykke, were you glad to be able to go to Saigon?
Oh, yeah. I want to see what's going on down there. It was a nice city, good restaurants.
And sure, yeah.
My friend in AID, he had a big apartment. I was in a little hotel room with another guy.
Is that where you lived for a while? Or
yeah, for 7 months.
For 7 months in Saigon,
yeah.
In a hotel?
Yeah.
Do you know, where was it? What street was it on?
Oh, it was the New Brinks Hotel, they call it. The regular Brinks Hotel was a luxurious thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was riding back, I don't know, a street. It was two blocks from Tudor and one block across the back of the National Assembly.
Okay.
And it had a Chinese restaurant on the first floor,
mm-hmm.
which we called Cheap Charlie's. And then I was on the hotel at the airport.
Okay.
And my roommate was a Korean Navy chaplain.
How did that come about that you two hooked up?
I don't know. I just was in that room.
Huh. Now,
he used to chew this dried squid. That was his sort of chewing gum. So I chew dried squid so I could stand the smell, yeah.
You had no choice, really.
That's right.
was he then, am I right in thinking, a Catholic chaplain?
I guess so.
And
I had no idea what he did.
How was his English?
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he had a son who had died in Korea, but they don't have emergency leave in the Korean Navy, apparently, so he stayed right on.
Do you think he was actually a chaplain? Or do
yeah,
you think
probably.
He was probably something else, too?
Well, no, he was probably a chaplain. I really didn't have much contact with him.
Now, let me ask about your job down there.
You're with
J-33. For somebody who doesn't know what that would mean, can you go ahead and explain that?
Okay, well, the military has four staff sections,
mm-hmm.
J-1 or G-1. J-1 is joint. G-1 is what we have in the brigade. It's personnel.
Mm-hmm.
G-2 or J-2 is intelligence. J-3 is operations, and J-4 is logistics. So this was the operations division of MACB, and they did all the operating, sending the troops out and writing the plans and so on.
And what was subsection then 3 of?
Okay, well, that was the Revolutionary Development Division. We were J-3, and they numbered all of them 3-1, 3-1, 3-2, 3-3.
Mm-hmm.
We were the Revolutionary Development Division, J-33.
Did you know what that meant when you?
No, I never heard it before.
Well, what did you find out it did mean?
It meant the Revolutionary Development Division, that we wrote NXP of the combined campaign plan. Well, I said we had three major functions. We served as the Revolutionary Development Division of MACB, J-3. We wrote the Revolutionary Development Annex, J-33. to the combined campaign plan.
Mm-hmm.
So we're supposed to know about what was going on down there. We served as advisors to the Vietnamese Ministry of Revolutionary Development. And actually, our whole staff section was right there in the ministry. And then we served as the staff of the deputy ambassador who was charged with supervising the U.S. Revolutionary Development Program.
Now, the Revolutionary Development Program...
That's another word for pacification, although the Vietnamese didn't like to use the word pacification because that's what the French were doing to them.
So there was a question, a little upset about the terminology.
Yeah.
So it was switched to revolutionary development.
Exactly.
Okay. And let me ask you first of all about the relations with the South Vietnamese ministry.
Yeah.
Who did you work with in that ministry? Did you have an opposite number?
Not really. We worked with the deputy minister. I think it was Mr. The Revolutionary Development Minister was General Tang.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who his deputy was. We worked for him. He was a very nice man. And we would, well, for instance,
uh-huh.
we would write our Annex B for the combined campaign plan. And then we would send it out to the Joint General Staff for approval. The Joint General Staff, being very glad to get it, would send it to the ministry and say, what's your opinion of this? And they say it's fine, and they send it to the Joint General Staff. The Joint General Staff would say it's fine and send it back to us. And then we give it to the ministry for our, or give it to MacLeod for our entry.
So the paperwork flow was quite a trail.
Yeah.
And it moved the plans and drafts.
We could advise the ministry, but we did it very surreptitiously. Having our advice come through the Joint General Staff.
And that was for protocol reasons, largely?
Well, no, it was for effectiveness.
Okay.
Well, it was for getting the Joint General Staff to approve of our stuff before the ministry did. And the ministry thought they were right on the ball.
Okay. Makes sense. And if you can, put us into the picture as far as the plans that you would work out. What kinds of things would be addressed?
We were given the task of coordinating the American effort, coming up with a plan to coordinate the American civil and military effort in Vietnam. Every district and every province in Vietnam had a military advisor, had a CIA advisor, they call them counter advisor, a Just Power advisor, which was USIA, Joint U.S. Public Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, they had an AID advisor. And nobody was in charge. I know in our, well, I was later, when I was tank commander, they would work not together. And so our task was developing an organization for a combined American effort in South Vietnam that integrated the military and the civilian effort. Because they all had their own chains of command and funding and so on. And so we were supposed to come up with a plan where somebody would be in charge.
And just bureaucratically, that sounds like a pretty sticky...
Yeah, it was.
A mission to get in the middle of.
That's right.
Oh,
I remember when I briefed Ambassador Lodge on that and told him what our purpose was. The AID guy said, well, we didn't persuade that at the highest level because we didn't think it was important. And the ambassador said to him, well, John, it was John Vann who said that.
Mm-hmm.
The ambassador said to him, well, John, I don't see how anybody can be opposed to that. So I gave my briefing anyhow.
Now, about when was that? Do you have an idea of roughly the
time?
Yeah,
that was about October of 66.
Well, let me...
because then, McNamara and Katzenbach and Comer came over and were trying to find out what was going on, and they were very dissatisfied, I was told, with the State Department and AID briefing, so they came over to the military and they got this briefing on how to put things together. And I briefed McNamara, Kastenbach, and Ambassador Comer. It says here in November of 1966, I briefed them, and they decided to do it.
Let me slow you down a little bit, Herb, because I want to ask about that first that time that you had John Vann and Ambassador Lodge both in the room.
Yeah.
What did you know about John Vann at that point?
Not very much, except that he was at AID and didn't like to coordinate with the rest of us.
he was kind of flying on his own.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What was? Did you have?
I never talked to him. I talked to another guy. AID, who was there and who reported to Van, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You don't remember his name, though?
No.
Well, did you have an impression of John Van he was in the room with you. Did you form any impression about him?
Well, just that he was hard to get along with and he didn't want to cooperate.
He was kind of a loner.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it. He was a loner.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't going to subordinate himself to the military or somebody else, which we were advocating.
Of course. And was this the first time that you had worked directly under Ambassador Lodge or worked directly with him?
Yes.
When you gave that briefing?
Yes.
What can you say about him he's a historical figure, of course, now, but at that time, you know, you were a hotshot young major.
Yeah. I found him very willing to listen.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. For ideas. Willing to listen. He said, John, I can't see anybody can be against that.
So he wasn't trying to take you apart or...
No. He thought it was great.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that then Secretary McNamara appeared with Robert Comer.
And Kastenbach.
Let's take them one at a time. Kastenbach, did you spend much time speaking to him at all?
No, I just gave a briefing to all three of them.
Okay, so they are the three guys in the room, and you're standing up at the front.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had three budgets, really. I had the budget, and I had the military plan, and I had the pacification plan. And I remember Comer said, we don't have much time. Tell us about the last one. That's the most important. And I said, no, sir, we think the second one's the most important. I'll brief you on that.
You thought the military plan was most important?
No, the civil plan.
Oh, the civil plan, uh-huh.
Bring them both together.
And he pretty much had to, did he just accept what you said?
Yeah.
He pretty much
my
had
to. My boss pretty much had to slip on it, but I gave him all three.
You kind of slipped it in there.
Yeah. And then what happened was that Kastenbach said, well, let me get the civilian side organized first, and he set up the Office of Civil Operations, and then we knew that wouldn't work, and then 6 months later they set up the courts under Comer.
Right.
And by that time I was back home.
Right. Did you form an impression of Comer, though, when you met him?
Well, not very much. When
not
I
really.
Met him, he said he was trying to give me what was important about my briefing, and I didn't accept it.
You had your own idea.
Yeah.
Well, did you realize, just stepping back and thinking about that that encounter, I mean, did you realize the importance of, you know, on the bigger screen?
No, I didn't.
I mean, you've got the Secretary of Defense sitting there.
Yeah, I didn't recognize it.
You just went, we're doing your
I just did my briefing.
Okay.
We thought it was pretty good briefing.
I'm sure that it was, actually.
McNamara said he didn't remember it, but Comer remembered it, because, you see, what Kastenbach said was, well, give me 6 months to get the civilians organized, and they gave him that 6 months, but we knew that wasn't going to work, so then they formed courts with Comer over there.
By
that time, I was back in the States working in the... in the operations division of the Army staff,
and the cords operation was much more closely.
Well, they were
military.
Setting it up, and I was one of the few people in the Army that could explained to General Johnston, the chief of staff, what was happening.
What kinds of, in an explanation like that, can you relay the sorts of things that you would want to emphasize?
Oh, yeah. I'd emphasize that we were making progress, that we were getting the civilians and the military to follow the same path. Really, I remember I'd walk into the Pentagon every morning about 7:30, and somebody would say, Chandler, the chief of staff wants to see you. And I'd say, well, somebody get me a copy of the New York Times so I can see what he wants to talk about today.
Well, before we go to Washington, let me ask a little bit more about your work in the Revolutionary Development Division.
Okay.
Who else was on the staff?
Two guys. Mm-hmm. There were two Army and Air Force majors. Jerry Britton was the Army major, and Charlie Cook was Air Force major. And we're the ones who put together, I think Jerry Britton had most to do with it. They chose me to give the briefings, because
mm-hmm.
I was better briefing, I guess.
But the plans were a joint effort.
Out. Oh, yeah, they were all a joint effort.
Okay. And who were you reporting to?
It was the chief of the Revolutionary Division. Well, it was the colonel who was chief of the Revolutionary Development Division. Colonel, I can see him right.
You can see him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it might come to you.
Yeah.
It might come to you.
I'm thinking about it. But we report to him, and he was happy to have it, and he's the one that got the briefing set up, I believe.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your life outside the office.
Yeah. No, there wasn't any.
You didn't have much?
No, we worked 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Go get something to eat and go to bed.
And
on Sundays, we would take off and maybe get a Jeep and go to the PX and see what they had.
Just for fun, to sort
yeah,
of go
just
shopping?
Just for relaxation. And
okay.
Some days we take off the afternoon to get a haircut. When you get a haircut, you get a massage and a
mm-hmm.
nail clipped and all that kind of stuff, mud pack, whole thing.
But this sounds this sounds pretty sedate.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Believe me.
How would you assess the security situation in Saigon itself?
There wasn't much.
Not much going on?
No, I didn't see any. I wasn't worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, we had a curfew at 12 o'clock, and sometimes you come out of a restaurant at 11 o'clock, 11:30, and these, they were mostly government employees with motorbikes,
mm-hmm.
and they would be taxis for you. And and you tap on the taxi, and you think it was a taxi, he would take you to your hotel or wherever you live.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out fine. And one time I got a guy who didn't know where he was going, and so I put my arms around his neck and said, take me to my hotel or I'll kill you.
Really?
So he found the place where he dropped me off somewhere.
Did you have, you must have felt slightly threatened. There was something going on.
Oh, yeah, he didn't know. He wasn't going to where I wanted to go. He didn't have weapons in Saigon.
And so, I just want to be clear. So you leaned forward and put your hands around his neck?
Yeah.
I would have taken you wherever you wanted to go.
He dropped me off somewhere.
Now, I just want to clarify, Herb, that your offices were on the MACVEE compound. Is that right?
No.
We were
in the Office of Revolutionary Development, the Ministry of Revolutionary Development.
Okay, so you were going into the ministry every day.
Yeah.
And how often would you go over to MACVEE?
Very seldom.
Was that because you didn't really need to, or?
We didn't really need to, right.
Okay. Did you have someone in MACVEE that you would relay?
Not below the J3, no.
Okay. So the J3 was the point of contact?
Yeah, for us.
Okay. Is it the case that is it fair to say that while you were with the Revolutionary Development Division that you were sort of laying the groundwork, at least in conceptual terms, for what emerged as the CORDS operation?
Absolutely. We wrote the whole thing.
We
were replaced by an ambassador, three of majors.
You were by Ambassador
Comer.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And he essentially picked up the threads that you guys had put
absolutely
in place.
He got it organized. He put people with the places they should have been.
Have you written much about your work, this work with the Revolutionary Development
Division? No, I don't think I've written anything.
Obviously people are very interested in the origins of chords and its early workings and then its eventual development.
Yeah, well, I don't know about its early workings, but we gave them the idea.
You gave them the idea?
Yeah.
And what would you say to someone who wanted to know what those principal ideas were? What how would you capsulize those?
Well, we said that somebody ought to be in charge of these four guys in this district.
Yeah.
And they ought to have a plan for that district or province. And we also said that somebody ought to be in charge. We said that 50% of American battalions in Vietnam should be engaged in pacification.
Really?
And development.
I was going to ask if there were any, if you introduced any targets or ideas.
Yeah, that was it. 50%
wow.
should be. When I got over there in 1970, two battalions out of nine in the 101st Division were so involved.
So that wasn't even close.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you think things might have gone somewhat differently in out in the provinces or in any particular region of South Vietnam if that kind of commitment to the pacification had been made earlier?
It might have been. The North Vietnamese made that commitment. And by 1965, when we first came there, they had already won out in the countryside.
You think they had already won?
Sure. They were in every Hamlin village in Vietnam.
I mean, that's quite a tall order to try to undo.
That's right. That's what Harrington, Colonel Harrington, in his book, well, you know, the VC would come in at night.
Yes.
And the American or the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese would come in the daytime. And all the village wanted to do was be left alone. Because VC would kill the guys that helped the Americans in the daytime. And the South Vietnamese would kill the villagers who helped the VC in the evening time. You know? So they were caught in between. They couldn't do anything.
Given that you think that, you know, essentially the communists had already, you know, won the countryside in 1965,
yeah.
Sitting back from it now, was there really anything the United States could do?
Not very much, no.
I mean, militarily, it's, you know, it's an extremely
militarily,
difficult...
Militarily, we found them when they wanted to be found. All combat was initiated by the North Vietnamese. D.C.
Mm-hmm. That they controlled the tempo and timing of interactions. Even though, obviously we controlled the air.
Yeah.
And we had all the technology.
Sure. We go out and if they wanted us to find them, we'd find them. If they didn't want us to, we wouldn't.
And is it fair to say that for the North Vietnamese, that was sort of the lesson that they learned from the Yadrong engagement?
Yeah,
was that
I would hope so, yeah.
They better not... It's not a good idea for them to come up to us, to come up to American
That's
forces
right.
face-to-face.
Sure. They learned that in November.
November 65.
Yeah, 65. And in December 65, in our past.
That's right.
Come against us, we'd kill them. Uh-huh. They didn't care. Well, they'd lose a few and replace them, and we would lose a few and not replace them. And the American public got tired of it. You know, what Westmoreland said was, we were going to do attrition until they got tired of it and didn't try to conquer the South.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? We got tired of it before they did.
Do you think that Westmoreland could have or should have been savvy enough to foresee that, you know, the American public would get tired of a foreign war before the Vietnamese would get tired of it?
I don't see how he could. No.
No?
He was trained to operate on the plains of Northern Europe and take Berlin.
Yes, sir.
So when you told him to come up with a political decision plan for the pacification of South Vietnam, he took Berlin.
He did Berlin?
Yeah.
You had already participated some 5 years earlier in developing some of the curriculum for counterinsurgency training.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see that as having an impact on thinking, Army thinking? About the war in Vietnam?
No. The Army tried to ignore it. We came up with this idea of the oil spot.
Yes.
And finally, after our brief McNamara and so on, we decided to set up a priority province for each core area. And we would fly out and examine these areas. We set up a priority province, and then we would try to pacify it and then spread out from there.
Right, using...
That's what we wanted these 50 battalions to do.
Right.
And using our courts people, of course.
Mm-hmm. And so sort of following in some way...
Yeah.
That British... idea of the ink spot in Malaya. I mean,
Well, the ink spot in Malaya was easier because they were different races, Chinese versus Malay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like the ink spot we tried to form in Europe, the same thing the special forces were doing there. So it was special forces doctrine to some extent, but it wasn't American Army doctrine. American Army didn't like it very much.
And especially, maybe you would agree, at the upper echelons where those guys were setting their
ways.
And you kind of, if I'm right, Herb, represented sort of the new brand.
Well, I hope so, yeah.
And your voices, it was hard to get across.
That's right.
To what extent, I mean, you're an old West Point grad, to what extent do you think the Army has... functioned then or even now as a bureaucracy and had that inertia problem?
Yeah, well, then it did. Now it's a little bit less because they're learning the lessons in Iraq.
And does some of that have to do with lessons learned from Vietnam?
Well, I doubt it. Everybody was trying to forget about Vietnam.
You think so?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's
interesting. They're learning the lessons all over again in Iraq because... they're faced with insurgency there.
Yeah. I know the same things do seem to appear.
Yeah. And so I think they are learning more how to deal with it in Iraq than they did in Vietnam.
So more lessons are being integrated?
Yeah.
Okay.
In Vietnam, we got to do everything we did in Germany, and that's what we were trained to do, but in Iraq, it's a lot different.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting problem, isn't it, this whole idea of, you know, a huge organization like the U.S. Army.
That's right, having all these separate little constituencies within it.
Right, and trying to kind of integrate new information on the go.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's
They had a bunch of meatheads. You know, they had a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Commander-in-Chief McVie who wanted to do it their way.
Did you have, I ask you this as a scholar rather than in your role as a participant, but as a scholar, what's your appreciation of General Wheeler?
Well, I didn't think he had much knowledge. He wanted to do everything Westmoreland wanted.
He didn't have any ideas
of his own. I interviewed him, and he said, well, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all we can do is pass on the request to the field commander, and that's all he did.
Is that what he told you?
Yeah.
And you interviewed him in the 70s? Is that?
Yeah, when I wrote my book, 74.
Yeah, so as part of the dissertation research?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what else did he have to offer? Do you remember?
Not very much. He said all we do is pass on the request to the field commander. We don't have any, planning ourselves. They do now a little bit, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But again, that may be one of the course corrections.
Yeah.
Well, Colonel, let's take a break for today.
Okay.